It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. A few years ago, writer Colin Murphy took a long, hard look at America's place in the modern world, and then he asked a simple question. Are we Rome? He went on to write a book with that very title, looking at the ancient world and the modern one, and concluding, not much has changed. Well, Murphy's back on the case. This time, he takes on the Inquisition, or rather, the Inquisitions with an S. The book is called God's Jury, and in it, Murphy argues that the Inquisitions that began in the 12th century were actually a harbinger of the modern world.
The temptation, I think, is to think of the Inquisition as a kind of throwback. Nothing quite says medieval the way the word Inquisition does. And my view is that you should actually adjust the lens fairly substantially. If you do, you begin to see that the Inquisition has a lot of characteristics that are not really medieval, but in fact modern. You know, there's always been persecution, there's always been hatred, but the Inquisition is something that is institutionalized. And institutions require a kind of infrastructure. You need to be able to keep records, to amass information, and then you need to be able to find it. And the fact is that in the late medieval world, these kinds of tools are finally coming into existence.
Surveillance, data collecting.
Surveillance would be another. Keeping tabs on what people are doing, keeping tabs on what people are thinking. So finally, these tools emerge. We see them around us in our own day all the time. We take them for granted. But it's not very often that we ask, when did governments, when did other institutions begin to have these tools? And the Inquisition is a good way to begin to answer that question because it relied on them, essentially.
What's fascinating is that certain techniques were so proscribed during the Inquisition. You talk about these Inquisition manuals, and you draw comparisons between those and modern manuals for interrogation.
It's uncanny. There was an inquisitor named Bernard Guy. He compiled an Inquisition manual for use by other inquisitors, and it became the basis of many such manuals. And if you look at that, and then you look at modern manuals for instance, police forces or the military, you begin to see that there isn't a trick that is used nowadays that wasn't in use by the Inquisition. The psychology of interrogation, the ruses that people would use when you're questioning, there's nothing new under the sun when it comes to interrogation.
My guest is Colin Murphy. He has written a new book. It's called God's Jury, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. At one point in the book, you draw a comparison between Guantanamo and the Spanish Inquisition. Can you explain that?
Guantanamo has been a symbol worldwide of many things, but one of them is interrogation gone wrong. And to me, it illustrates something that always happens when you try to put restrictions on a kind of behavior that is inherently problematic. The Inquisition tried to put restraints on torture. The problem was that in the moment, when people are trying to get information, those boundaries keep being pushed. People think, one more turn of the screw will get us one more little piece of information, and that will justify this very messy procedure that we really wish we didn't have to resort to. So that happens again and again, and torture creeps and creeps and creeps. The same thing happened at Guantanamo. If you look at the early history, the attempts to get information from detainees, you see the same kind of creep. So that is one thing that Guantanamo illustrates, where I think the parallel with the way in which the Inquisition proceeded is very close.
Towards the end of the book, you write that not only do all the ingredients for a modern-day Inquisition exist today, but also that they are more prevalent than ever before. How so?
Well, this is a real worry of mine. There's one thing that every Inquisition needs, and that is a person, people, who are possessed of an idea. They think they're in the right about something, that they want everyone else to toe the line. And you see this in religion, you see this in totalitarian regimes, but that moral certainty isn't enough. You need to have something that sustains it, that gives it life over time. And those things, like having a bureaucracy, having methods of surveillance, information technology, all of those things are much more advanced right now by an order of magnitude than they were centuries ago. And many of these things are more or less on cruise control. We know what bureaucracies are like. They don't shrink, they expand. We know what surveillance is like. Nowadays, it's done almost automatically. Every time you hit the keyboard on your computer, or every time you walk by a camera on the street. So my worry is, what happens when you combine that idea of moral certainty with the kinds of tools that exist nowadays? You know, it does seem to me that in the wrong hands, the tools of repression are just more available and dangerous than they have been for a long time.
I should probably mention that you are a Catholic and a practicing Catholic. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
And as you point out, many accounts of the Inquisition have been biased, either overly critical of the Church or overly defensive. And understandably, the Church has been prickly about accounts of the Inquisition. But what does the Inquisition tell us about the modern-day Catholic Church?
Well, the Church certainly has been prickly about the Inquisition, and there's a lot to be defensive about. There's no way that you can paint the Inquisition in a lovely light. I'm a Catholic who has, you know, long had issues with his Church, and one of those issues has to do with a basic mindset. And you can think of it this way. Is the Church and its teachings fundamentally about absolute certainty that brooks no discussion, or is it fundamentally about something else? Is it about humility? Does it have a place for tolerance and for doubt in a constructive sense? And these two traditions fight with each other throughout the history of the Church. And for a long time, the first tradition has been in the ascendant, and I think it's time for the second tradition to emerge.
That's Vanity Fair editor Large Cullen Murphy. His new book is called God's Jury, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. Cullen Murphy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
A federal appeals court has struck down Oklahoma's ban on Sharia law. The ruling said the state amendment, which was passed in 2010, discriminated against Muslims. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
70% of Oklahomans passed the amendment to their state constitution. It barred courts from recognizing Sharia law, that is, Islamic law, as valid. Supporters said they weren't singling out Islam. It applied to all religious laws. Still, they only mentioned Islam. Dan Mack, an attorney at the ACLU, says, in effect, that meant that Catholics or Jews could make agreements or draw up wills that cite their religious beliefs, but Muslims could not.
The Constitution flatly forbids the government from singling out one religious faith for official opprobrium, and this so-called Save Our State Amendment does just that.
A Muslim man named Munir Awad sued. He argued that he wanted his estate distributed according to Islamic law, and that under the ban, a court could not execute the will. Soon after that, a federal court in Oklahoma temporarily blocked the ban, ruling that it violated Awad's First Amendment rights. Today, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver agreed, ruling unanimously that the state was favoring all other religions over Islam in violation of the Establishment Clause. Ira Lupu, a religion law expert at George Washington University Law School, says the ruling is no surprise.
I would have been shocked if there had been a contrary outcome. Every responsible First Amendment religion clause lawyer in the United States, of whom I'm aware, as soon as this was passed, before it was passed, when it was being considered, looked at this and said, this is clearly unconstitutional.
Now the case returns to federal court in Oklahoma for a hearing on whether the injunction should be permanent. Oklahoma's attorney general says he will continue to defend the ban. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Two of the top Republican contenders in New Hampshire are Mormon, Mitt Romney and John Huntsman. And that's made life interesting for two young Mormons who have been going door to door in the state. They're campaigning not for Romney or Huntsman, but for Jesus Christ. Ike Srikandaraja of TurnstileNews.com caught up with the two missionaries in Exeter to hear how they're balancing politics and proselytizing.
Most canvassers wear candidates' buttons and carry campaign signs, but these two young men stand out for having neither.
We're definitely in the spotlight. Generally, walking around New Hampshire in a suit and tie with a name tag makes you in the spotlight.
That's Elder Taylor Bales, a religious title the Mormon Church gives this missionary, even though he's just 20 years old. His canvassing partner is Elder Kyle Hodson, who's 21.
From 10 o'clock until 9 o'clock at night, we go out, we talk to people on the streets, we knock on doors.
These two want to share their faith, But a few days before the New Hampshire primary, there's something else people want to talk to them about.
Who are you voting for?
Definitely a topic of conversation that comes up quite a bit.
And the obvious question to ask a couple of Mormons this year?
Two people, like within just a couple of minutes of each other, asked us the exact same question. They yelled at us, Huntsman or Romney?
But it's a question they can't answer. Despite the fact that John Huntsman and Mitt Romney are both Mormon,
the church has a long-standing policy of neutrality as far as candidates and parties. As representatives, we mimic that neutrality. But, you know, we are people. We do have opinions. We just choose not to voice them during these 2 years that we serve.
But Hodson held a day planner with a blue bumper sticker that seemed to say otherwise.
Mostly we were just in Hampton the other day and Mitt Romney was holding a breakfast and we walked by and they gave us stickers.
We actually thought we'd try and collect as many as we could, so yeah. It's not really much of a preference. It's just more for fun.
Yeah. So I'm looking for like a Ron Paul sticker, like Newt Gingrich, Rick Perry, whoever can give me a sticker. That's what I'm looking for.
So a Romney sticker this year might just be decorative. But when Hodson does become politically active, he won't necessarily vote his faith.
I wouldn't consider myself smart if I chose to just vote for a member of the church, just because I'm a member.
For now, though, they're in the political dark. During their mission, no newspapers or TV, just scriptures and hymns, and 30 minutes of internet a week at the local public library.
We're on Mormon.org, and this is the Our People tab.
Bale scrolls through a checkerboard of Mormon faces.
There's an opera singer, a mathematician, high school student, artist, cancer survivor.
He knows the story behind each face. It's the only website these guys are allowed to visit for 2 years. And this, the Our People section, is based on the multi-million-dollar I'm a Mormon campaign, aimed at defying Mormon stereotypes, advertising the church is a big tent. It's even got an Australian professional athlete.
I'm taking a break from rugby league to serve a volunteer mission. My name is Wilhop Wari, and I'm a Mormon.
The faith had a different face a generation ago, when Huntsman and Romney were just boys carrying out their own missionary rites of passage.
John Huntsman served his mission in Taiwan, and Mitt Romney served his mission in France. Yeah, the Paris, France mission.
Now those former missionaries are going door to door trying to persuade New Hampshire residents to believe in them as presidential candidates. So who has the harder job?
I'd say it's probably harder for us to do our work than it would be for a campaigner.
The message that we share, it's, I don't know, when we go and talk to people about Jesus Christ, we not only help them develop a faith in Christ, but help them act on it. And that usually involves making some changes in their lives. And a lot of times those changes can be hard.
Probably harder than picking a presidential candidate. For NPR News, I'm Ike Sriskandaraja in Exeter, New Hampshire.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. In a landmark decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that church employees whose jobs include preaching their faith cannot sue for employment discrimination. It's the first time the court has recognized a ministerial exception to anti-discrimination laws. But the decision applies to more than ministers. It can apply to church teachers and other employees. As we hear from NPR's Nina Totenberg, the case began with a Lutheran teacher fired over a disability.
Cheryl Parrish, a teacher at the Hosanna Tabor Lutheran Church in Michigan, took leave when she was diagnosed with narcolepsy. But when her doctor certified her to return to work, the school asked her to resign. And when she threatened to sue under the Americans with Disabilities Act,
their response was to fire me. I can't fathom how the Constitution would be interpreted in such a way as to deny me my civil rights as an elementary school teacher.
The school did not dispute it fired Parrish because of her threat to sue, but it maintained that part of its faith requires that such disputes be resolved only internally within the church. Today, the Supreme Court said the church acted in accordance with the Constitution's freedom of religion. Writing for the court, Chief Justice John Roberts noted that since the passage of the Civil Rights Act nearly a half century ago, the lower courts have carved out an exception that allows ministers to be hired and fired without regard to civil rights laws. Today, the Supreme Court made that position the law of the land. But on the more difficult question of determining who is and is not a minister, the court was equivocal, saying that would have to be determined on a case-by-case basis. The court, however, used Cheryl Parrish's case to set out some broad guidelines. It agreed that even though the bulk of Parrish's time was spent teaching secular classes like math and science, she still qualified as a minister. She led her students in prayer each day, escorted them to chapel, taught a religion class four times a week, and she was what the church designated as a called teacher, as opposed to a contract teacher. While contract teachers had the same duties, the court said, Parrish, in order to qualify for tenure, completed an ecclesiastical course of study at a Lutheran college, and after passing an oral exam, she was issued a ministerial commission. None of these factors alone would be determinative, said the court, but taken together, they were. Chief Justice Roberts acknowledged both the interest of society in enforcing anti-discrimination laws and the interests of religious groups in choosing who will preach their beliefs, teach their faith, and carry out their mission. The Constitution, he said, strikes the balance in Parrish's case by requiring the church to be free to choose those who will guide its way. Experts were divided today about just how far-reaching the court's decision is. University of Virginia law professor Douglas Laycock, who represented Hosanna Tabor, saw the ruling as a home run for the church.
It is unanimous. It's unanimous that she counts as a minister. It's unanimous that ministers can't sue. It's unanimous that it doesn't matter whether the church had a religious reason or not. The courts can't inquire into that. That's the story here today.
George Washington University law professor Ira Lupu agrees.
When the court says you can have no inquiry into whether this religious reason is pretextual and just a cover for some kind of discrimination, that is a big deal.
Others, however, disagreed. Here's Daniel Mack, director of the ACLU Program on Freedom of Religion, which filed a brief supporting Parrish.
Obviously, we are disappointed in the result, but really in the grand scheme, I don't think that the implications of this case are all that broad. It's a relatively unique, limited set of facts.
Other experts also characterized the decision as narrow, noting that religious organizations did not get what they ultimately wanted, a total immunity from lawsuits. Indeed, the court acknowledged the parade of horribles that some have suggested, that a church could fire someone for reporting sexual abuse to police or for reporting school health and safety violations to civil authorities. And the court today went out of its way to leave those kinds of questions unresolved. Justice Thomas, in a concurrence, said he would have completely deferred to the church on all such questions. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.